podcast this week. It's a brand new day for Destin Daniel Cretton, the director of Spider-Man Brand New Day, as he talks us about that movie. How exciting! Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that really, really hopes that Emily Wilson never writes a review of this podcast. It would be devastating, a blow from which we would never recover. And the food looks awful, and such small portions too. Oh my word. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. I am back from the San Diego Comic-Con, and I'm welcoming you to the Empire Podcast. I am joined in the pod booth, not on a roof at the Hilton Bayfront Hotel in San Diego, but in the actual pod booth here in good old London, England, by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here.
Hello.
The nicest serial killer in the business, Ben Travis, is here.
Hello.
And this week, someone was heralded in a trailer as the Master of Misfits. And I think erroneously, because the real Master of Misfits is right here in front of me, Amon Warman. How are you?
I'm good. I think. Even after that intro.
Well, we're trying to reclaim it from Johnny Depp and Ebenezer. I think it belongs to you, that title.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
That's a man we all want to be associated with.
How are we all? How was your Comic-Con?
It was a very computer-based, putting your articles in the computer, into
your
the internet.
Articles.
That's what my job is.
Yeah.
But you did a great job. You gave us
Thanks,
a great report.
Don't encourage him.
Yeah. It was fun. It was an interesting time. I'd forgotten. It's been 9 years. I don't think I mentioned that more than 10 times. It's been 9 years since I, and indeed Empire, were at Comic-Con. I was at Comic-Con. Were at Comic-Con. Wow, this is going well. Was at Comic-Cons. And it was almost exactly the same, and yet had changed in kind of weirdly imperceptible ways, but it just felt slightly different. But I'd forgotten what it was like to one-man band that, because I one-man banded it back in the day. Like the first 3 or 4 times I went to Comic-Con, I think it was a one-man band. And then we started like adding reinforcements and it became more manageable. But I did. I had, as I said on our Comic-Con podcast, I recorded with Dan Jolin, who was there, but not in an Empire capacity. It was like I had a lot of Sophie's Choice moments, but worse than the film.
No.
You know,
no.
Choose between Reacher and the Apple TV panel. And I chose poorly. But the Marvel panel was excellent. Listen, we'll get into it in our news section. But right now, should we have a question or 10?
Yes.
Sure.
All right, let's do it. So these are from Instagram. Here's one from Sophie S. Hall, or Sophie's Hall. How do you feel about authors publicly criticizing movie adaptations of their work? Now, shall we give this some context for anyone who doesn't know what I was talking about in the intro?
This is about Emily Wilson, who is the most well-known modern translator of the Odyssey and indeed the Iliad, a very, very learned Greek scholar who has done incredible translations of both those books, wrote a review of Christopher Nolan's Odyssey in the London Review of Books that brought down the website and became a bit of an online sensation because she didn't like it very much. Her issues were about things like the near total removal of the gods from the film, certain choices that Nolan made, certain historical inaccuracies. A lot of it, I think, is totally fair and I don't care because I still like the film. But look, she's absolutely entitled to a very strong opinion on this because very few people, I would hazard, know the Odyssey better than she does.
Yeah, she's not unknowledgeable on this topic, let's be real. At the same time, I don't know, she's coming to it from a very different place to the majority of audiences, to me, to a lot of us in this room. And I don't know, some of the criticisms to me seem either somewhat unfair or just less interested in engaging with what Nolan's kind of take on the Odyssey is, because it's all adaptation, it's all interpretation, it's all, I find it fascinating. I love when a filmmaker we like adapts such a well-known story and you see what their kind of personal feelings are towards this story, what they're seeing in it, what they're saying about our time through the conduit of this other story. We've had that earlier this year in Wuthering Heights. We had it at the end of last year with Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. Like, we have had versions of these stories.
And the authors
many
of those
times.
Stayed silent on the subject. In
dead
both
silent.
Cases. Dead silent.
Not a single word.
Undead silent in the case of Frankenstein.
It's interesting as well, though, because this question could also possibly allude to, we just got the trailer this week for Children of Blood and Bone, the upcoming Gina Prince-Bythewood movie that is a big, like, Afro-fantasy, YA-ish adaptation of a series of novels by Tomi Adeyemi, who has distanced herself from the films for reasons that are not yet particularly clear. Mm. She co-wrote the screenplay.
I mean, I think in that case, obviously, we don't know yet what changes have been made that may have caused the objections. I mean, but there have been cases in the past, like Anne Rice was up in arms about the film version of Interview with the Vampire and then saw it and loved it. So it can happen that an author comes back around. Stephen King doesn't like the Shining, the Stanley Kubrick Shining. So authors are not always, you know, the only judge of their work. And of course, in this case, translators. I thought it was a really interesting piece to read. Like I say, I disagree with a lot of it. And I don't care about the stuff that I kind of agree with. Like, I'm like, oh, yes, she did make that. He did make that choice. Don't care. You know, I don't care about the historicity of some of the ships or some of the armor. Don't care. He's clearly made visually driven choices there. And in the case of the ships, there may be an element of, we actually want these to go on the sea. So we may have to make some compromises design-wise to do that. And I think that might have been a role there. I haven't talked to anybody or read about that. Mm. But I suspect that was a thing there, because Greek ships in those days had to hug the coast, basically, as I understand it. Yeah, it was an interesting piece, though. It's worth a read, but I don't think it's definitive by any means.
It's just very interesting that she's done this, as she's put her head above the parapet at this time, because the easy thing to do would have been to keep quiet and rake in the cash from that this movie's going to make her.
She's already raking the cash. Weirdly, her dad, who was also an academic, was famous for his literary feuds.
Wilson, the volleyball from Castaway.
No, but a different Wilson. Wilson. There's more than
there's more than one Wilson.
Yeah, more than two even.
This
is
how I find out. So to quote Emily Wilson, this is amazing. Nolan's Odyssey lacks many of the elements that make the poem great. Doesn't rhyme, for one thing. It has nothing convincing to say about time, memory, history, war, or about the relationship between one warrior's glorious return and the lives of his family, adversaries, comrades, friends, and neighbors. It lacks psychological, emotional, political, and ethical depth. Its narrative structure is gimmicky. The writing is abysmal. None of the characters has convincing motivation for their actions or words. There are no sex scenes, and all the food looks horrible. But apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, did you
why doesn't she tell us what she really thinks?
I know, right?
Reading between the lines, there's some good stuff in there.
I think it's a low three myself, says Emily Wilson, but I could be talked up. You never know. That is scathing, because I'd first heard that she had like criticized it, but I didn't realize she leveled it. Like, this is both barrels type situation.
Yeah, a little bit.
But yeah. You know, I, fair play in a way, because it shows that she has integrity.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's all good. Amon, where do you stand in this? You've been conspicuously quiet.
Nah, it's because I'm nodding in agreement with what Ben...
It doesn't pick up on the microphones, Amon. We've talked about this.
Shocking. Films are subjective. We all have opinions on this. And
I don't.
Reading a different take can at times be very interesting. There have been a number of films over the years where there's a certain consensus that's very positive, and I'll read something that's very negative, and I won't always agree, but it makes for a really interesting read, and this is just another in the series of those sorts of things. So,
I think it's really interesting sometimes a new version of a story that keeps the narrative intact can also flip the initial meaning of that story, because the Emily Wilson essay, she's very concerned with the fact that the film is not interested in the idea of glory, which to her, I think, comes across as like a really integral part of the Odyssey, the sort of glory of Odysseus. And the film, no spoilers, but is sort of flipping that idea on its head. Mm. That what we understand as sort of Odysseus's mental state is sort of inverse to that. And it reminds me of the Guillermo del Toro Pinocchio, where the whole point of the Pinocchio story is that he's like, we've got to keep this kid on the straight and narrow. He has to learn the moral lines of the world and stay within those lines to be a functioning member of society. And the Guillermo film flips that on its head. It places it in the sort of context of a fascist regime, and it celebrates the fact that Pinocchio is unruly, that he doesn't abide by the rules, that he charts his own path. It kind of celebrates that about him whilst also being a faithful retelling of Pinocchio. So this is what I mean when sometimes whatever filmmaker is involved, they can apply interesting meanings and interpretations to these stories whilst also engaging with the initial meaning as we come to understand it.
Yeah. And Nolan has done stuff like that before, even taking the Dark Knight trilogy. Looking at what Nolan did with that story, there's a number of things that he does with Batman that I wouldn't characterize as like my traditional, my favorite version of Batman, especially when it comes to a Batman that's always looking for the way out of not being Batman. Batman, in my mind, is very much about the mission always. But Nolan has earned the right to take swings with the story while still taking bits and pieces that he does like from the comics and the source material and adapting it in his own way, as all artists should. So I got no issue with that.
I think I want Chris Nolan's next movie to be an adaptation of Emily Wilson's review of The Odyssey. I think
it
would be amazing.
Full of sex scenes and incredible looking food.
No, we don't need Chris Nolan sex scenes. I'm still scarred by the one in Oppenheimer.
Where does that come in your Chris Nolan alphabet book, which is out next year?
Oh boy.
Thank you. I didn't mention sex scenes in it because there aren't enough of them to fill a
R for rumpy pumpy.
R for rated. It is we're going to get into this in the Odyssey spoiler, which we still have to record. But
yes.
Like, there is an issue that, like, there is more. It's not like explicit or anything, but there is more.
There's rutting,
shagging
in
the poem, and I think it does make a difference if you're imposing sort of Hollywood morality on these ancient Greek characters, which they kind of are. So he's kind of, as far as we see in this film, faithful, spoiler, and that's not reflected in the, that doesn't entirely reflect the poem. So it is kind of a whitewashing of his moral character, I guess.
Yeah. God, she's going to go fucking nuts when she sees Spider-Man Brand New Day. There were no sex scenes.
I wasn't familiar with the poem before sort of watching The Odyssey, and I've since read up on a certain things, and yeah, there's questions that I have about Odysseus's journey back to Ithaca. I'm told there's some stuff with Circe that happens.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, kind of blew my mind a little bit.
From Game of Thrones.
Imagine that scene, again, no spoilers, but that scene plays out the way it does. And Odysseus says, before I leave,
boom, chicka, wow, wow.
In fairness, and I'm not going to, again, we're getting really into spoiler territory because lots of people are waiting for IMAX tickets and won't be seeing it for a few weeks yet.
Or iSex tickets.
No.
No.
But but he does actually practice safe sex in that scene. So it he really actually does think things through before he agrees to woo-hoo with the
right.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
Odysseus says, pull out, kids. Emily Wilson, is that canon? I don't know.
Is that a canon in your pocket? Is that a wooden horse in your beach, or are you just pleased to see me?
Boy.
All right. Okay. Some people asked about the best movies where people have amnesia. Sorry, I've forgotten. B.H. Pitt says, there have been 11 theatrically released Spider-Man movies. What's the best one?
Into the Spider-Verse is still number one for me.
I think he might be right.
It's so tough. Spider-Verse feels like it has all this additional context to why it's so special. But then Spider-Man 2 is there.
Great.
It exists.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
And I'll be honest, I rewatched No Way Home the other night, and I don't know if any of the others have quite so many punch-the-air moments as that one does. Like crying, screaming, laughing, throwing up, the whole thing.
Sex scenes.
in that one. I just like it really. It's kind of three films in a trench coat. Like it's kind of just strung together around amazing moments. But the amazing moments are so amazing, you know. Mm. So that's high up on my list. But I think in terms of filmmaking as a whole, I think in terms of delivering the emotion, the action, the character of Spider-Man, I don't think you can beat Spider-Verse
has the punch the air moment of all punch the air moments for me, which is that leap of faith, which I don't think there's any scene in any Spider-Man film, many of which I love, that quite matches that, at least for me, and how it makes me feel on a personal
okay,
level.
Okay, that or Thor in Wakanda.
Why are you doing this to me? Oh man. Oh gosh.
Only one of them actually ends in triumph. Because Thor's return to Wakanda in Infinity War is ultimately laced with grim defeat. Mm. Like 5 minutes later, it's like, you might as well not have bothered, mate.
Don't say that about that. Oh, I think I'm going to have to go with Thor.
He comes back to Wakanda just to fuck things up. When Banner goes, oh, you're in trouble now, he's actually talking to the Avengers.
It's so hard to cross the streams on all these generations, right? I think if you're talking Raimi, it's two. Yeah. If you're talking The Amazing Spider-Man, what
it's
are you
not.
Talking? For me, if you're talking the MCU trilogy, yeah. as it was now a quadrilogy, mm-hmm. honestly, Homecoming, I think, is outstanding. I think in a world, if Booksmart didn't exist, Homecoming would be the best teen comedy of the last 15 years. It's like
interesting
genuinely take. Just incredible and so fresh and fun and funny and light on its feet. And Neighborhood Spider-Man, it gave us the friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. And then in terms of Spider-Verse, it's hard because Into the Spider-Verse is so perfect and complete and whole. Across the Spider-Verse pushes everything further in ways that I just think is so, so special. But because we're on that cliffhanger, it feels a little bit incomplete at the moment. And I wonder if when Beyond the Spider-Verse comes out, if that hopefully also knocks it out of the park,
yeah. mm-hmm.
if having that kind of resolution then lets Across the Spider-Verse sort of rise maybe above Into the Spider-Verse as the number one of that trilogy.
Mm. Mm. Interesting. So no love then for The Amazing Spider-Man 2. This is a big shock.
I actually prefer 2-1. I don't know if that's
really?
A controversial opinion. That first Amazing Spider-Man is so dour and grey, and it's so caught up in like post-Dark Knight. Oh, we've got to go gritty with it, and we have to do some kind of mythology about Peter Parker's parents. And then,
oh, it's so bad.
At least awful. For all the mess and messiness happening in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, it has that through line to do with time and making the most of time and how that ties into, spoiler alert for a very old movie and a major thing in comics, Gwen Stacy's death,
mm-hmm.
whereas The Amazing Spider-Man is just such a mishmash of shit anyway. And then when the lizard stuff kicks off, there's no thematic through line to what is happening with that movie. It's just like, there's a lizard now, and I guess he's Welsh.
Yeah, I will say, I will agree with you in that The Amazing Spider-Man 2, the filmmaking definitely levels up. The web swinging in that film might be the best web swinging that we've got in any Spider-Man film. Like, it's really... Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Interesting.
It's really,
like,
really
is
good.
Is it the opening of the film where he's like free falling through the sky and you can feel the fabric flapping on his back as he's rocketing down? It's really impressive.
I'll be honest, sequence. I haven't revisited. I tried to revisit Amazing Spider-Man a couple of years ago and I got halfway through and I genuinely couldn't finish it. And so as a result, I haven't gone back to revisit Amazing Spider-Man 2. I'm not expecting to find any kernels of previously unmined delight. I might be wrong on that one, who knows? But it's such an obvious... for me, there's a big three in this, and that is Spider-Man 2, Into the Spider-Verse, and No Way Home. And I love the John Watts trilogy. I think they're all terrific entertainments. And I really like Brand New Day. We'll get onto it in the review section. You talk about a Spider-Man movie that's darker and a bit more gritty and a bit more mature and adult, but still remembers to have fun, unlike the Amazing Spider-Man films. But for me, it's the big three. And I go back to, you know, kind of how they made me feel, you know, Spider-Man 2 is as close as we're going to get to unfettered Sam Raimi directing a superhero film, which is just amazing. Into the Spider-Verse, you know, I still kind of, I'm in awe of what they did with that movie and the envelopes that were pushed. They created envelopes that hadn't been created before and then they pushed them. That was how incredible that movie was. And then I think about just the way that No Way Home hit me in the feels repeatedly and perhaps even cynically, but fuck it, it worked. So I don't know. I'm going to take the fifth in this one and go for a tie. All right. Shall we have a little break?
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's do it. All right, let's have a little break and then we will come back and we will talk about movie news and all the things that have been happening in the world of movie news. As ever, if you are an Empire Plus subscriber, you will hear no adverts. If you are not, then you will. Here they are. Bye, stuff. Bye. All right, folks, we are back. I hope you enjoyed those adverts, or not if you're an Empire Plus subscriber. And hey, while we're trying to flog you stuff, come along to our live show, September 5th, Saturday, September 5th at King's Place in London. Tickets are still on sale right now to come along and see the colleagues of Such Lethal Cunning do their film-related fun stuff on stage, Hall 1 at King's Place. It's going to be a lot of fun. Go to kingsplace.co.uk to get tickets for that. And I believe also, Ben, you're going to be doing a live show on the same day, right?
We are. Disneyversity is back. First time in 3 years at the Podcast Festival. It's crazy it's been that long. We will be also on Saturday, the 5th of September.
Not at the same time, right?
It's not like the same time. We're at 4:30 okay. in the afternoon. So you can do both if you would like to do both. That would be
and you
incredible.
Should.
Yeah, we're going to be doing The Nightmare Before Christmas, big classic Disney favorite. Sits a little bit outside of our usual roster of films, which is what we tend to do with our live shows. So yeah, it's going to be really fun. Come dressed as a goth or dressed as a non-goth. It is up to you.
How's Bells? What are you going to come dressed as?
Probably a non-goth out of those options.
Have you ever gothed?
No, I was kind of more grunge.
Okay. Amon, have you ever gothed?
No.
Good avenue of conversation. I'm glad it went down. All right, so shall we talk about some movie news?
Let's
I got nothing for you, I'm sorry.
There's a cul-de-sac. Quick, reverse. All right, let's do some movie news. So let's talk about some of the stuff that was announced at Comic-Con last week. It was obviously the Marvel panel, the Marvel Studios panel. They brought pretty much the entire cast from Avengers Doomsday out onto several stages at Hall H, which I believe is a first in the much vaunted history of Hall H. So they had an X-Men stage right at the back and a kind of separate Avengers stage right at the back, so the people at the back would feel connected to the show rather than having to peer and see, oh, is that Kevin Feige in the distance? Is that Robert Downey Jr. in the distance? And suddenly there's like, oh my God, I've got James Marsden right next to me. Kelsey Grammer is here. Oh my God, he's listening. They dropped some Doomsday footage. Do you guys want me to very quickly explain it to you?
Yes, sure. You've seen things we people couldn't believe.
I know. Attack beams off the
shoulder of Orion?
Fucking, yeah, I can't remember that. yes. Kevin Feige on stage of Paul H. Ryan Reynolds wearing denim. I've seen things, you people. All these things will be lost in time, like tears and rain. Anyway. So the Doomsday footage was very portentous. It's got a very somber, ominous tone to it. It basically featured Vanessa Kirby as Sue Storm going, oh, the Victor Fondue man knew. Oh, you'd have loved him. Oh, but then he lost everything he loved. And there was a picture of his wife and child getting into a giant fridge. And then he's like, oh no.
Was there like iPhone footage of him like laughing and smiling yes. on a bridge on a lovely crisp autumn day with
pretty
a big
much
scarf?
In Latveria, with the Latverian flag fluttering behind them. And then she goes, but I knew he was lost, but I didn't know he was broken. And meanwhile, there's like lots of shots of like the various characters in the movie all looking very worried about stuff. And then there's like shots of some, sorry folks, you can read about this online as well, but you know, there's like a shot of some, like a scene of utter devastation that clearly Doom is responsible for. And then you have Pedro Pascal as Reed Richards confronting him and going, Victor, did you do this? So this movie confirms what we already knew, because Matt Shackman had said the same in our spoiler special, that Doom, this Doom, the Robert Downey Jr. Doom, is from the Fantastic Four's world and is pals with the Fantastic Four, or was pals with Reed and Sue, certainly. And so that history will, A, be established here, but also will play into what happens in Doomsday. So that, you know, the fact that Pedro can go right up to him and confront him and yell in his face, even when he's pretty powerful, is, I think it could be quite emotionally affecting, but we shall see what happens with that. And then we get to hear more of the Downey Doom voice, which we heard in the Doomsday trailer. He basically goes, "You are all living stolen lives." And then we see shots of various people. And the only one I really remember is Loki, who is living a stolen life. Mm-hmm. And now you must give them back. And I'm wondering, is that what he's doing? Is he trying to, you know, is he doing his own version of pruning the multiverse in an attempt to stave off incursions? What's going on? And then we see some other things. And we see an extended version of the Thor versus Doom confrontation from the trailer. And this time I wrote this down. Thor says to Doom, "I swear you will beg for hell before I grant you it." Mm. And then he tries to smite Doom, and then Doom smites him, and he's recovering from this. And then Doom goes, "Hell answers to me." Mm. And then he does his magical wavy hands thing, like Paul Daniels. You'll like it, not a lot. And then he conjures up from behind him an army of sentinels.
Oh,
and
no.
At that point, it seemed like Hall H just lost consciousness. Like, just en masse.
Everybody blacked out.
Everyone just passed out for a second. And you could argue, of course, yes, that this is a very cynical thing, like dropping Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield into Spider-Man No Way Home. And they know that people of a certain age and disposition will lap this shit up. Mm-hmm. But by fucking God, it worked. the first thing I said after coming around from my days was, "Two tickets for Avengers Doomsday, please." So evidently it worked. And then I went to the press line afterwards and spoke to the Russos and Feige and Simu Liu and other people, as well, Hayley Atwell and other folks. And it was a fun time. So that footage, primo. And my understanding is that there's more in the movie.
Interesting.
That, yeah, that it's not just that. Yeah.
Wow.
That it's not just that.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Nothing gets past you, Chris.
Honestly. I'm like a one-man Woodward and Bernstein.
Christian, 2 minutes with Kevin Feige. Question one, will the movie be longer than that?
I actually did ask the Russos a version of that question.
Wait, what did they say?
They confirmed it's going to be at least 30 seconds longer.
Woo. Okay.
Because the names of the people who worked in those 2 minutes have got to go up on screen. So.
Right. Yeah. The names at the end with the people who worked on the movie.
The twist of Avengers Doomsday. So that's exciting. Any more things you want to ask me about that? Or are we good?
Well, I have other Marvel things to ask you about. I feel like I'm tapped out on Doomsday a bit. Okay. But footage was the biggest thing in the world.
It was the meat in a big announcement sandwich.
Mm. Externally, that was like one side of the bread, and the meat was Black Panther 3.
No, the meat was Avengers. Okay, so just structurally, the panel was a bit of bread, which was Ryan Gosling being announced as Ghost Rider in a 2028 film to be directed by Sean Levy.
Mm-hmm. Luxurious bread, we should say. Not
yes.
Like bog
standard. Oh, no, this is like rye. Is rye good bread? I don't know. I like white bread.
So rye and Gosling?
Oh. I'm getting the sense of your Subway order here.
6-inch meatball marinara, please.
Okay.
No sex eat. So
what bread?
Italian.
Oh, it's very plain.
Fuck you. Wow.
Like the hearty Italian?
Yes, me too. There you go.
What's the difference between the Italian and the hearty Italian? Helen, tell us. no, Jenny, what is the difference between a hearty and Italian?
It's got crunchier. Like, crunchier.
I don't want crunch.
A bit of herb.
I like my bread to be, like, not gooey, but soft.
What? It's liquid, Chris.
That's oh, boy.
Don't you like liquid bread? Anyway.
Chris, that's Huel.
You
Chris
don't
is a
like
guy.
Liquid bread. That's beer.
This has gone badly. That's this episode title. This has gone badly. Anyway, so rye in Gosling was the first layer of bread, right? And then that was followed by the Doomsday unveiling, which took ages and had all the Avengers and the X-Men and then Downey on stage as Doom. And then they showed the footage and then the Roosters as well.
So that was the meatballs.
And then that was the meatballs.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And then they brought out the hearty Italian, which was Ryan Coogler coming on stage, not like that, to announce Black Panther 3. And I heard that all the way from San Diego. Because Amon, you were live texting me, which was lovely, but also very much unappreciated because I was trying,
Chris is live tweeting and
trying
watching.
To work. And you were like texting me shit. I'm like, what were you doing up, man? It was 1:30 in the morning.
Listen, when it comes to Comic-Con, that's the way that I experience it, unfortunately, for now. Like, I want to, at some point, actually go, because it is the mecca of all geekdom. It is literally nerd nirvana. I need to go at least once to experience it. But yeah, for now, like, I had like 5 feeds open. I was just refreshing and seeing the Empire feed, seeing the other feeds, like, okay, what's going on, and reacting to whatever the
you're seeing other feeds. Okay.
And were those other feeds giving you what you wanted, or
sometimes?
Didn't know we were open about the feeds.
Yeah, and why was Empire not giving you what you wanted? What can we do better?
If Empire wasn't tweeting fast enough, maybe there was somebody on my right to blame for that with all the texts.
Can I just say, my fingers were fucking flame that day.
Flame on.
Yeah, but I was mainly doing very, very stupid jokes. But neither here nor there. And then the panel started and the live tweeting just stopped because it was so interesting because, you know, because everything was happening. And, you know, because I was a one-man band this year, so I was trying to film some stuff so we could put video content up later on, because a lot of sites and whatnot seem to be doing that this year. So I thought, okay, if you can't beat them, join them. So I tried to do some video stuff. And then because you were standing up, I wasn't able to get to my laptop to live tweet. And so the live tweeting kind of just, I haven't gone back to the feed, but it's pretty much like, now the Russos are here to bring some Avengers Doomsday footage. And then the next tweet is, David Johnson is the new Black Panther. And then it just stops because I had to run to the press line and I wasn't able to do anything else after that. And then I, you know, went home and slept after that. But anyway, not home, the hotel, which felt like a home. It was a lovely hotel. Anyway, so they brought out Ryan Coogler to announce Black Panther 3, which has a release date of December 15th, 2028. Mm-hmm. And they brought out Letitia Wright and Winston Duke, who had been on stage previously as part of the Doomsday Cavalcade. And then they announced the big bombshell, which was that Black Panther 3 will feature the new T'Challa, who, of course, is the son of T'Challa and Nakia from the Black Panther movies. And it's David Johnson.
Hooray.
It's only bloody David Johnson.
Love it. Love it, love it, love it.
Mm-hmm. Great casting.
He's great, yeah.
He's so good. It's perfect, perfect casting. He has a kindness and a decency that I think is going to be absolutely crucial for the role. There had been speculation that something like this would happen, but the speculation had been Damson Idris. And then I guess they saw Rye Lane. And they were like, yeah, he's done.
Mm. I feel like we'd talked about this, hadn't we, in the podcast? I know you tweeted about it, Amon.
Yeah.
But I feel like we talked about this at one point in the podcast and his name was mentioned, because he is a fantastic actor. He's so likable, as you say. He has that decency to him. I'm not 100% sure how they work this out on a timeline level, but I guess that will all become clear.
Yeah. For me, in my mind, it's not even about a time jump so much as it is about what the MCU will look like post-Secret Wars. Because they're
saying,
going to keep some things the same and they're going to change whatever they want to. And I think this is going to be one of the changes, having this grown up T'Challa now. But yeah, I love it. And I just think there's just so much trust I have with Ryan Coogler, especially. Like, all the things we're saying about why David Johnson is perfect for the role, the criteria for Ryan to say what he's saying about David Johnson, knowing the Chadwick of it all, knowing the franchise as intimately as he does, you know that his standards for this role were ginormously high. And David Johnson has clearly passed that test. So very, very happy for him. As someone who has gotten to speak to him a number of times, I feel like a little bit proud of him as well, that he's come so far. He's been on just the last couple of years, especially The Long Walk, he's fantastic in. Rye Lane, you mentioned, he's the best thing about Alien Romulus. So yeah, very, very happy with this and very excited for him.
I feel like The Long Walk is a really good one. If people aren't familiar with his game, and you really should be, we've been recommending Rye Lane now for I don't know how many years. Mm-hmm. But definitely watch that. But also do watch The Long Walk, because I feel like that has that mix of you know, implacable sort of integrity and cool and just a sense of himself as a person, you know, just that mm-hmm. centeredness mm-hmm. that he has in that role, I think is a really, really interesting kind of model of the kind of Black Panther that we could maybe see from him.
Mm-hmm. I think that really stood out as well, because Chris, you got the story from Feige.
Yeah, good job on that.
The casting of David Johnson, and that that casting has been it happened like 5 or 6 months ago. This has been in the works for a little while, but Feige told you the story of Ryan Coogler meeting with David Johnson and coming out of that meeting, and there's a really significant part of the quote that he gave you, which is he's a good man mm-hmm. and he's the yeah. next Black Panther yeah. and mm-hmm. as you say, that sense of decency is so core to Black Panther, the assuredness that we absolutely got in Chadwick Boseman's T'Challa, the quiet confidence is so key to that character, and I think we see that in David Johnson and his other performances, but I thought it was so significant in the, you can read the full story on Empire Online, Chris's quotes from Kevin Feige, of him being on the receiving end of that messaging from Coogler of, I just met with him and he's the new Black Panther, he's a good man, I thought it was a lovely story.
Yeah.
I just also think that this further validates Ryan Coogler's decision to not recast the Chadwick Boseman T'Challa, which he was under a lot of pressure for in certain quarters to do. Not only did it give us as a film watching culture a chance to collectively mourn Chadwick Boseman, which is a very unique thing to happen, but I think deserved for an actor who was very beloved to a lot of people. But now you can have a T'Challa and sort of start fresh in a way to give him his own set of problems and challenges to overcome, and also not have that be wedded to certain other things. Like that, this means that Chadwick's T'Challa can forever remain sort of attached to Nakia, while as this new T'Challa, I mean, we're going to see what the MCU is going to look like post-Secret Wars, but I'm imagining that they're going to want to do something with Storm. There's actually a lot of rumors that Ryan Coogler is overseeing the casting of Storm to maybe be in Black Panther 3. And obviously we know in the comments that Storm and Black Panther are a thing. So yeah, I just think it validates that as well.
Other things happened. Do you want to talk about them?
Yeah, there's been some trailers we should probably talk about. Just before we came into the booth, the new Jumanji open world trailer dropped. So the concept this time is essentially the first Jumanji has finally happened. That Jumanji has come into the real world and we're getting all the wild animals and crucially the characters in the real world. This looks really fun to me. I'm extremely amused, both by sort of demo mode versions of these characters.
The running is fun.
The running is really fun, but also they do eventually go into the game at one point, and then new people are in the characters, and it gives them some new colors to play. And I'm super hyped for that as well, because it just looks like an interesting and a fun wrinkle for, you know, our sort of core game cast of The Rock and Kevin Hart and Jack Black and Karen Gillan all to play. So this is honestly super sold, yeah. Really into it.
Yeah. It does look fun. I think they've done a good job of, you know, in turning these films basically into body swap comedies, of finding fun new remixes of like, this person's in that body yeah. now. And we've got, even in the last one, it was Danny DeVito in the body of The Rock is inherently funny. That's a great comedy concept. I did think it was a little bit interesting that like the setup is Jumanji's in the real world now, and then even halfway through the trailer, it's like, ah, we're going back to the game.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe that's something that can't really sustain a whole movie in this version of Jumanji. Obviously, as you say, that is also the concept of the original Jumanji, is that the stuff comes out of the board game into the real world.
I presume across cuts between...
Yeah, I'm guessing. I don't know that everyone's in the game by the looks of this. It doesn't feel like they are, and feels like quite a few of our heroes are still outside. So presumably there's a dual quest that needs to be done.
Yeah.
It is something, though, where, like, how is this going to fare? Is it 7 years since the last one? Was it 2019? Because they went up against Rise of Skywalker and actually did pretty respectably, made a good, like, I think maybe $800 million.
You could draw some conclusions from that about Rise of Skywalker, man.
Made a hell of a lot more than many other movies recently. But, you know, those two Jumanji films, they're really fun. They came hot off the heels of one another. Both did very well financially as well. It has been a big gap. The hierarchy of power in the DC universe and the rest of Hollywood has significantly changed, especially when you think of the one of the main stars of these Jumanji movies. On the other hand, the Jack Black stock continues just to like rocket upwards. There is a whole generation of kids now for whom Jack Black is Minecraft and the Mario movies. And so, you know, this is a little escalation from that. I'm sure this will be a 12 like the others. I think it looks fun. It's just 7 years is a long time between Jumanji sequels.
You forget, though, that in the interim, Dwayne Johnson and Jay Kasdan, the director, made Red One, and that won the hearts of millions. And I think it's really continued the magic of the Jumanji movies. And if they can recapture the Red One magic here, then boy, boy, oh boy, are we in for 2 hours of a movie.
Well,
you mentioned the 7 year gap. I was also intrigued by the release date because it said, well, Ben mentioned the 7 year gap. I was also intrigued by the release date because it says Christmas, and June's Day is December 18th.
Yes.
Combine that with the 7 year gap, and that's kind of a ballsy.
It's a ballsy move.
Release date, don't know if it's going to pay off for them, but we shall see.
Fingers crossed.
Mm.
There were some more trailers to talk about. So the trailer for the second trailer for Adam Wingard's Onslaught has been revealed. That was at Comic-Con. That was one of the best panels I was at, actually, hosted by Kevin Smith. It was great. Had everyone there, Audrey Arjona, Drew Starkey, Dan Stevens, Rebecca Hall. It was a really, really fun panel. What did you guys think of the trailer for this movie that isn't The Guest 2, but kind of is The Guest 2? And I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately, when the dust settles, it is actually The Guest 2. But what did you make?
I had a really good time with it. The action looks incredible. Mm-hmm. There's one shot, I think it's actually the shot that we've used for the screenshot for the story on the site, but it's Dan Stevens and he looks a little bit like Batman.
Dan Stevens looks a little bit like Batman. Show it to me.
See if I can find it. 1 second.
Is this something that you have, Amon, where you look at everybody and they look like Batman?
Promise you it's not.
Because Amon came out of Spider-Man Brand New Day and went, oh, that was an amazing Batman movie. Did you... I thought Tom Holland was great as Batman and Zendaya was magnificent as his girlfriend, Batman.
Well, I can't find it.
No, you take your time.
Thank you. You guys just stole.
Helen, what have you been up to while I'm on?
just
making a mess of
it. Keeping on.
Tell me this does not look like Batman.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Is that Dan Stevens? I don't think that's Dan Stevens, first of all. But I think that's one of the three killing machines.
Okay.
The super soldiers who are unleashed upon...
So he has the top half of his face painted black. His eyeliner has run catastrophically. Like, we're talking sort of Charlize in Fury Road kind of eyeliner.
Yes.
Smudging. Yeah.
But I see where
you're coming
Thank
from.
You.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So I don't think that's Dan Stevens in that shot. Dan Stevens in this movie doesn't play David, who is the unkillable super soldier that he played in The Guest. Now, Adam Wingard has confirmed that this movie takes place in the same town as The Guest, and that these super soldiers who are making Arjuna's day a bad one are from the same program that David was from. But Dan Stevens in this plays, I believe, the inventor of that program, the founder of that program, who is a fucked up, weaselly little Nazi dude in his 80s or 90s or 100s. It's undetermined, who likes to lick Rebecca Hall's feet.
Well, down with that sort of Nazism. I leave the feet stuff to your own conscience.
Surely down with all sorts of Nazism, right?
I mean, yes, but I just wanted to make clear I wasn't like kink shaming anybody. Certainly wouldn't kink shame anybody for fancying Rebecca Hall. That seems like a rational position for people to take. You know,
totally rational.
But the rest, I'm down on Nazis.
Yeah, Amon, you into feet stuff?
No.
Okay, great. Yet another conversational cul-de-sac. Unbelievable. This looks great. I know the fact that Dan Stevens is playing a different character would seem to indicate that this isn't The Guest 2.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be 100% surprised. This is not an Amon guarantee. This is not a you better believe a buddy. This isn't even a Benny guesses it or a Helen or high water.
I don't think that's a thing. I have never endorsed this.
And yet there are t-shirts made with it on there. What can you do? I'm not saying that this is any of Lowe's, but I'm saying that if Dan Stevens were to turn up in a dual role and David from The Guest were to show up in this movie, I would not be surprised, thus making it a guest two after all. But
it's a guess.
This movie doesn't have a UK release date yet. Mm. Who do we lobby? The new PM? Who's it this week?
It's very hard to keep track. Yes, by the time this goes out, it could have changed.
It could be Amon. Amon, are you the new PM?
Trying to keep it a secret, Chris, but yes I am. Yes. Can I just say, you're talking about Adria Arjona and this film, she did a couple of interviews for Comic-Con.
Yes, she did.
And
she says, I'm Batman.
Well, there was one question she was asked about Man of Tomorrow.
She was incredibly evasive.
It's very obvious that she's playing Wonder Woman to me now.
It does feel that way. Did you see this?
Not Maxima, that much anticipated DC character.
Yeah. It's very obvious.
You're saying this woman who looks exactly like Wonder Woman might be playing Wonder Woman? I, for one, am shocked.
Gee, I wonder who this woman is playing. I think that's pretty much nailed on, right? Would you take Dan Stevens as the Bat? The DCU Bat?
Would you take him?
Here's the thing about Dan Stevens.
Hashtag Bat Not Blonde.
He can dye his hair. Kilmer was blonde.
He cannot dye his hair.
Kilmer was a blonde bat.
That was a huge roaring success, wasn't it?
It's beloved. Batman
Forever is a good Batman film.
I enjoyed Batman Forever, but it wasn't a huge roaring success.
I'm on. I cannot sanction your buffoonery. I'm sorry. But here's the thing about Dan Stevens. Obviously, Empire Spirit Animal.
Sure, love him.
Good looking guy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Good actor.
Yep.
Absolutely weird little dude.
Yes. And I think that's the thing that it means he's not Batman.
He's perfect for Batman.
No. They already have a weird little dude playing Batman.
No, but not in the DCU.
I know. But if they go DCU, I bet you they go more like less weird. I bet they go more mainstream. Otherwise, if you just want a weird little dude, get Pattinson.
But he's...
Neither of them are that little, by the way. Like, no disrespect, but they're weird.
How do you feel about Alan Ritchson as Batman?
Too big.
Can you imagine people? The secret identity thing just would not fly. It's like, who could possibly be Batman as Bruce Wayne walks through the door, taking it off his hinges?
But he's used to the animated series where that is basically what Batman looks like.
This is true. But Batman should not have more muscles than Superman. I think that's generally where I am. And listen, I love Jack Reacher. I love that he plays himself in that show. Mm-hmm. It's terrific. And I like that that Jack Reacher has turned this into a career of picking largely terrible movies. Although I hear that his new movie, Motor City, is actually quite good. It opened in the States and died on its arse at the weekend, but apparently is quite good.
Nice.
So well done to Jack Reacher. But as Batman, no, I don't see it. I'm fully prepared to erase this tape when he's announced as Batman in 6 months' time.
He's been giving into his way. He's been saying like he's had a number of conversations with James Gunn about all in the DCU. So
How I think those conversations are going. Can I play Batman, please, James Gunn? No, Jack Reacher, you're the size of a fucking boat. You can play Boatman. How about that? No, thank you. There is one more trailer to talk about. So this is the trailer for The Thomas Crown Affair, which is the film, the remake, the second remake of the classic 1960s Norman Jewison, Steve McQueen, Faye Dunaway movie. Featuring the sexiest game of chess of all time. I think they were fucking those two. There's something about the way they were. I don't know.
Kasparov versus Deep Blue was pretty sexy.
I think it was Kasparov versus Deep Throat, actually. But come on now. Come on, guys. But this promises to be even sexier than that, and even sexier than the 1999 remake. I want to say 1999. Sure. Directed by John McTiernan, starring Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo. The temperature was scorching. The chemistry between those two. But the chemistry between these two in this movie, which is directed by and starring Michael B. Jordan as Thomas Crown, who is a rich dude who likes to pull heists, right?
Yeah.
I think that's basically it. Although this might be tweaking it slightly.
Well, the poster suggests there's a revenge element in this.
He has said that, yes.
Yeah. And this trailer implies that he may have been racing against his rival question mark, Kenneth Branagh question mark, Russian accent question mark, and that maybe some kind of shenanigans went down leading to Thomas Crown going through a car crash question mark.
I'm Thomas Crown broke his crown.
Maybe.
And then came tumbling after.
So maybe that's why he's out for revenge. I'm literally just going off the one viewing of the trailer.
So they're tweaking this. They're tweaking this. But I will say that the sexiness quotient is off the fucking charts.
Yeah.
Because I think these two are going to have chemistry to spare. I'm talking, of course, about Michael B. Jordan and Ken Branagh. It's going to be... No, wait. Whoa. It's Audrey Arjona. She's in this movie as well.
Oh, my God.
Great week for her.
I was watching the trailer before she appeared, and I was like, they've cast someone impossibly hot in this movie opposite Michael B. Jordan. I know they have, but I can't... Oh, yes, of course. It's like, yeah, Wonder Woman! And she appeared. That's it. By magic.
Yeah. Spinning around.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm really, really excited for this. I enjoyed the trailer. When... The trailer, it comes up from Academy Award winner Michael B. Jordan. I did smile at that.
Yeah, that was kind of...
Yeah, I know, that's right. That's awesome. But he directed Creed 3, which I thought was a solid directorial debut. Really good job with that. And yeah, to take this on is ballsy because, as you mentioned, the two Thomas Crown Affair films we've had before are pretty damn good.
They're good.
Yeah. They're good movies.
They're good movies.
On one hand, I feel like we don't need a revenge motive in this because it's a caper and he literally just does it for shits and giggles because he's too rich and has no other way of really, you know, firing up his adrenaline, right? That's the idea, and certainly the 99 one. I guess that is unappealing now from our rich people.
Not only was he rich, he was a rich white person. And this is definitely just by virtue of Michael B. Jordan in the titular role, is not that which changes things.
Okay, so then he doesn't need a revenge saga.
Well, maybe he does. I mean, maybe you introduce an emotion to it as a good thing. But frankly, I want our rich people to do fun shit like this. I want our rich people to pull heists where they're actually stealing artwork rather than, you know, stealing oxygen and ruining the world. I mean, stuff like that.
I mean, that's true. But yeah. I do wonder if there is a question mark there over how sympathetic you can possibly make a art-stealing billionaire in 2026. That'll be interesting. But look, if it's just like impossibly hot people like sexing each other up and playing mind games, I'm for that every 30 years. Just keep remaking it.
I hope they sing I Want to Sex You Up by Color Me Bad.
Oh my God, yes.
Oh my God. It's the sexiest song of all. You know, if you notice my voice, it got extra sexy because I'm just talking about this
yeah,
song.
Yeah.
Oh. I want to sex you up.
It's not appropriate in the workplace.
Okay.
Lucky fella.
She's not here. You're trapped in this room with me, Amon. Oh, and by the way, I am into feed stuff. I'm not. It's disgusting. No kink shaming, but just smelly. Are we done with talking about the trailers? The lovely trailers?
I think so.
All right. Because now it falls to us to talk about something much, much sadder. The great Glenn Hansard, who was the star, and along, of course, with Marketa Iglova, the Oscar-winning composer/singer of Falling Slowly from John Carney's Once. And Glenn Hansard was a musician, he was an actor, he was a singer, he was a songwriter. He passed away very suddenly in a motorbike accident in near Dublin.
You didn't realize how far his influence went, but you know, there were things like he used to busk every Christmas to raise money for a charity in Dublin, and got incredible stars out to busk with him. Like, he had Bono busking with him.
Wow.
And that kind of thing. As part of that, he did a lot for charity that way. The Frames obviously have, you know, just one of the best live acts out there and have a huge fan base. But also, just for somebody who didn't make very many films,
yeah,
had an incredible hit rate. I remember him as Outspan in The Commitments,
yep,
so cold for his orange hair. But then to follow that up with Once, to work with John Carney. He had a little role in Cyrano, which, you know, is kind of a curiosity. But otherwise, you know, he didn't do a lot of films, but the ones he did really made an impact.
The great Glenn Hansard, who passed away so suddenly at the age of just 56. Also, someone who passed away this week was the great Chuck Russell, who died at the age of 74. Now, when I say the great Chuck Russell, as a guy of a certain age who grew up in, as a horror guy, who grew up in the 1980s, Chuck Russell was a pretty huge name in 1980s horror because he was the director of A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, which is arguably the best Nightmare on Elm Street movie, mm-hmm. certainly the best Nightmare on Elm Street sequel, and was absolutely terrific. But he also directed a film that is, I think, really hard to find. It is his remake of The Blob, so which is about a gelatinous alien life force that attacks a small town. And The Blob, the remake, is vastly superior to the Steve McQueen original.
Yeah, yeah.
Remake that, Michael B. Jordan. Let's do that. Should be your next. I would love to see that. Michael B. Jordan is The Blob. What?
He wouldn't be.
What
the,
an acting challenge that would be.
You think Steve McQueen was The Blob?
No, Steve McQueen was not The Blob. Steve McQueen was fighting The Blob.
So why would Michael B. Jordan be The Blob?
Because it's an acting challenge. No one has ever been The Blob before.
Right.
What a great opportunity to show your acting range.
I think it might be tough for the most chiseled man in Hollywood to play The Blob, if we're honest.
He is so sick of his diet by now. He wants to cut loose.
Yeah.
He wants some McFlurries. Michael B. Jordan wants to be The Blob. And I think this is the way he could do it. Anyway, if you haven't seen The Blob, try and find The Blob. The Blob is, I don't think it's widely available, but it's a really, really cracking film. And then as a director as well, Chuck Russell had success with the likes of The Mask.
Yeah.
He is the guy who introduced Cameron Diaz to the world. He also directed Arnold Schwarzenegger in Eraser.
I got a soft spot for that film.
Yeah, and he was just a very, very solid writer, a good genre director who perhaps never really took off after The Mask and Eraser. But those two movies, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and The Blob, will forever put him in the horror pantheon for me. So very, very sad news indeed that we lost Chuck Russell as well at the age of just 74. We have to bring the news section to an end, sadly, because we're running out of time. But I believe the new issue of Empire is on sale right now. Is this true?
It is.
Is this true?
The Rings of Power issue.
The issue forged in the fires of Mount Doom.
Which was a problem at first because it's made of paper and it kept burning up. Mm-hmm. But we managed to find a way to make it stick.
We figured it out.
Yeah.
It's also got my visit to Aardman in it for their 50th birthday.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And also we've got a Wildwood pullout and much, much more.
Much, much more is cracking. Rings of Power Season 3, Sauron himself is on the cover of that. It's on sale right now in all good, evil and virtual newsagents. We will, of course, be doing the deep dive, the shameless plug with Nick Dissembly and the editor of Empire in a week or so. But yes, go and buy Empire right now. All right. Should we have a guest?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Shall we have a guest? Who technically hasn't happened yet, so I don't know whether it has happened yet, but I hope it's going to happen.
Let's assume it's going to happen.
All right. It is Destin Daniel Cretton, who is a fantastic director of the likes of Short Term 12, of course, and Just Mercy, and he moved into the MCU a few years ago with Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, and he liked it so much, he stuck around the MCU. He was, I believe, the first director on what is now Avengers Doomsday, was back then Avengers of Kang Dynasty. He has also co-created Wonder Man, which is about to start shooting its second season. But he has jumped over from Shang-Chi to Spider-Man with a Spider-Man Brand New Day, which sees Tom Holland return to our cinema screens for the first time in 4 or 5 days. Very, very exciting indeed. And he's brought his little scene friends with him, Zendaya and Jon Bernthal, along for the ride.
It'll
as
never
well.
Work.
It'll never catch on. We'll talk about this in depth in just 2 seconds, but I am literally in about 18 minutes racing out of here to talk to Destin Daniel Cretton. So let's hope it happened. And here it is, if it did. Destin Daniel Cretton, director of Spider-Man Brand New Day. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
You're doing a lot better than I am.
We're on opposite ends of the spectrum. I'm a bit jet lagged and sleepy, and you've been running.
I've been running in 33 degree heat, which we're not used to. I'm just looking at me. I'm a freckled Irish guy. I'm just not used to temperatures like this. It's ridiculous. People will have heard on our podcast, because we literally just finished recording the podcast, me tee up this interview.
Oh, really?
And I say, like, I'm literally running out the door now to talk to Destin Daniel Cretton, and I don't know whether it's going to happen, so I hope it does happen. So this is good. We're off to a good start.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize I'd be so flustered and out of breath. So you know what I'm going to ask about this movie is, so you just talk for 20 minutes or so and I'll just recompose myself over here in the corner. But no, of course not. talk me through that journey. Talk me through how we got here to this point, because Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings comes out a few years ago now. What was your focus at that point? Were you thinking Shang-Chi 2?
Yeah, I mean, Shang-Chi 2 was definitely something that we've been trying to develop from the get-go. But there were a lot of things that happened around that time. I mean, there was a couple of strikes. We were going through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So the industry went through a lot of things around that time. So I was kind of just going with the flow. I took some time doing some TV.
Yeah.
And spending time with the family. And yes, Avengers came along, and then Spidey came along, and here we are.
That seems like a shortened version of the journey.
It is.
What was it like in terms of, you know, the success of Shang-Chi? Because obviously, yeah, I think going into the MCU from your background, which I guess is fair to say have been largely independent to, mm-hmm. up to that point, the success of that movie in the middle of a pandemic as well is particularly impressive. So did it change your life overnight? Did it change how you were perceived in Hollywood? Did it change the opportunities that were coming your way? Was that something you had to take stock of for a minute or two?
Yeah, I mean, everything. I've never really had too many moments where it feels like, oh, my life is completely changed in this moment. Yeah. Everything feels like a stepping stone or a shift. And Shang-Chi was a huge stepping stone, I would say.
Yeah.
And I learned so much in that movie. I learned how much fun it can be working on these big, big canvas movies. And it allowed me to explore doing that with some other movies, some that didn't work out, but allowed me to get into this one.
What did you enjoy about working on a bigger canvas?
I love being on set, and I love being on set with a big team of really talented people who are passionate about something. And there's something about these movies, these superhero movies, that everybody just gets giddy on set because we're tapping into some part of our childhood. You know, everybody who is working on these played with these toys or read these comics or have some type of piece of their childhood is wrapped up in this, and being around that energy is really, really fun for me. I also find that it's really gratifying to search for the part of these big movies that I personally connect with, and just try to, you know, cling on to that over the course of shooting these big action scenes.
So let's jump ahead then to that and that personal connection with the movie and with Peter Parker as well. What was that personal connection for you? What was your way into the character and into the movie?
I mean, Peter Parker has always been, you know, I you hear everybody say this in various forms. I grew up on Maui, and I have really no cultural connection to a kid growing up in Queens who has spider powers, but he's still the character that I chose to dress up with like on Halloween, and the character that I gravitated towards. And I think it's his imperfections. It's his, it's him being bullied at school. It's him being making tons of mistakes and still moving forward. It's his pain of his past. And somehow this character has a way of staying really positive and joyful and funny despite all of the obstacles in front of him. That's the base layer of why I've always connected with him. But in this particular movie, starting in a place with a character who is literally entirely alone in the middle of one of the biggest cities in the world, that feeling is something that I have definitely been through at certain points in my life. And I felt like that was a very exciting place to start a character for a movie.
And try and forge connections from there.
Yeah.
As well. It feels like a very New York film as well.
Very much so.
Steeped in the city.
very much.
Not necessarily always shot there, of course. But yes.
So, as close as we could get.
How difficult is it to shoot a New York movie not entirely in New York?
Well, when you have Charlie Wood as your production designer, it's anything is possible. And we started with all of our department heads in New York City. We all went there, and that was where we first met together and walked those streets, took photos, and just felt the vibe of the city. And that was where we initially set the goal of, like, how do we capture the heart of this city in our movie and not make it feel like we are on a film set. We didn't want the movie version of New York. And Charlie Wood and his team really set the tone on creating, I mean, that we built one of the biggest New York backlots in the world right here in outside of London at Pinewood. And when you go up and when you walk those streets, we had people from New York come and walk our back lot, and they were blown away by the details and the grittiness. You can almost smell the trash and the amount of like detail that Charlie Wood put into the trash and the dirtiness was pretty profound.
Brand new day, smell-o-vision. That's the next thing.
Yes.
Now you can see.
I would love it.
You can smell what Spider-Man smells like.
Oh yeah, I would love to smell what it's like being in Peter Parker's grungy apartment.
In your opinion, what does Spider-Man smell like?
I bet you he does not smell that great. I mean, the dude is wearing basically a wetsuit while he's swinging and working out all day long. That I think that thing probably needs a wash.
Maybe just one reason why MJ's like, I don't know you. Dude, you smell horrific. I want to talk about the sequence, the Peter Parker or Spider-Man sequence that made you feel like a kid again. Is that something we can talk about, or is that a big old spoiler? On set, shooting it, going, okay, this is...
Yeah, we can talk about any... I mean, there are many sequences in this movie that made me feel like a kid, but one in particular, I have a photo of myself when I was about 5 years old. My older brother was seven at the ish at the time. I'm wearing a Spider-Man tank top, and my brother Denim is wearing a Hulk tank top, and we're just two kids in our backyard in Haiku, Maui. And when I stumbled across that photo recently, it just was baffling to me that I'm doing a movie with both of those characters in it. So that sequence in particular, between Spider-Man and the Hulk, was it was so fun to shoot. And yes, it is one of those scenes that does require a lot of VFX, obviously, because the Hulk is not a practical thing. But the way that we shot it was having Mark and Tom on set together. Mark was in his mocap suit, and we shot the entire scene as if I was just shooting a movie, you know, and shooting a regular scene in a movie. And so they were able to improvise together and create the scene as we shot. And that mocap suit captured his entire performance, and that's what the animators used to turn him into the Hulk. But the playfulness of that scene was really, really felt like we were tapping into something from our childhood. It was really fun.
Do you think in shots, so for example, when this came your way, when Brand New Day came your way and the chance to direct Spider-Man, you know, the minute you're offered the job, do you think, okay, I have a million shots, I have a million things I want to do with Spider-Man that haven't been done before, a million angles we haven't seen of him swinging or climbing or doing whatever it is that he does, and I want to get started right away. Is that how you think, or are you thinking story first of all? What's
Story.
What's your driver? Okay.
Story. Story first. I mean, sometimes you get certain shots in your head or you know, like certain frames from different comics that you want to see in the movie and you put it up on the wall. But it rarely works to try to jam those into a story, but you kind of have it up there and sometimes they'll just, oh, that'll actually be perfect once the story catches up to it.
Yeah.
But, yes, for this, it was definitely story first.
How set in stone was the story when you came on board, or were you able to forge it from?
It was not set in stone.
Is it set in stone now? Because I know how Marvel work. Is the movie completely locked?
We might go back and do some tweaks. Who knows?
But it's pretty much set in stone. Okay, so but it wasn't at the time. So how did you forge that? How did you?
Chris and Eric were our screenwriters at that time, and I jumped in with them in the. In the writer's room, and it was wonderful. They are incredibly collaborative, and they had been working on this, on versions of this for a good year and a half or 2 years or something. And so they had a lot of ideas on the table, and we just hopped in together and started figuring out what our story was going to be. But the core idea was always the same, which was Peter Parker is entirely alone, and what does that isolation do to a person who is part man, part spider? For normal human beings, we all know that isolation is incredibly harmful psychologically. Total isolation can also be harmful physically and can do, you know, damage to your body. Your body just does not like to be completely isolated from people. So to take that into the context of a person like Peter Parker, that was always the goal, to understand what would happen to him if he was completely put outside the context of his community. And then to watch him go on the journey of relearning the importance of connecting with people.
And he's older as well, mm-hmm. you know, which you skip through very gracefully. You bring us up to speed on how old he is. 75, I thought, was a bit of a bold gamble, but...
Yeah, Tom Holland in an old man suit.
Tom will still look the same age when he is 75. It's really depressing. But you said that you know, that in a way you felt that kinship with him. That you've been alone as well. Was that like adjusting and moving to a big city? Was that the time of isolation for you, or and were you as alone as Peter is in this movie, where he has nobody to talk to?
I mean, there are. You know, when I moved to San Diego from Hawaii, it was definitely a big shift for me, and it was hard. But there are certain times in my life, like when my dad passed away, when I've gone through a major breakup, when I finished college and had no job prospects and didn't know what I was doing with my life. There are certain sections of my life where was I as alone as Peter Parker? Literally, no. Did I feel as alone as Peter Parker? Definitely. I think my brain, the human brain, can very easily trick you into thinking that nobody else understands what I'm going through. No one has ever been through something like this. Nobody understands my pain. So I'm not going to share it with anybody. And I'm just going to, you know, grit my teeth and go through it alone. For my response was very similar to Peter Parker's, which was, I'm just going to work. I'm going to do nothing but work. And that was when I would just buckle down and make movies. What I discovered over time, and what I see Peter Parker discovering over the course of this movie, is that we, as much as we sometimes believe we're entirely alone, we're really not. And if we open our eyes and look around, there are people who fully understand what we're going through if we just kind of put the feelers out.
Did you have a friend as sociopathic as Frank Castle who helped helped reconnect you with society?
No, but I wish I did.
Everyone needs a friend.
Everybody needs a Frank. Everyone needs a Frank Castle.
Can I be Frank? I need a Frank. I want to go back to the journey from Shang-Chi to Spider-Man, because there was an Avengers detour along the way. You were working on what was the Kang Dynasty, and obviously that didn't happen for a number of reasons that were beyond your control, but what was that experience like, and why did you take that gig as well? Was that something that you felt that, okay, this is a huge opportunity, I've got to do it?
Yes, it was a big opportunity, but I also really liked that character. I really liked Kang, that character, and I had a lot of fun playing in that world and figuring out what that story was going to be. But you know, for various reasons, it didn't work out. I was bummed about it, but then this new opportunity came along, and I was very excited to play in another sandbox.
How long did it take you to say yes when Spidey was offered?
I mean, it took me about 10 seconds to say I was interested.
What was the conversation? Were you just talking to Kevin and he was like, well, what do you want to do next?
Yeah, he just said, what do you think about Spidey? And I said, yeah, that sounds really cool. Where are you guys at with it? And at the time, there were a number of things that were up in the air. So it took a little bit to, I just kind of kept doing other things that I was doing. And then the subject was brought up again. And then this time it was to go and meet with Amy Pascal and Tom Holland and Zendaya and then the writers. And I was just kind of gathering information to understand what everybody actually wanted in this movie, mm-hmm. and what I was stepping into, because I was the outsider coming into a pre-existing group and family, and I was trying to find out if this was like a happy family or a dysfunctional family that I was stepping into. And you know, to my relief, everybody was kind of speaking the same language when I was asking them what they want, what their hopes and dreams were for this next movie, from Tom Rothman at Sony to Kevin to Amy to Tom Holland and Zendaya, and everybody was kind of wanted the same thing. They were after a movie that was, you know, more grounded, more street level, something that really felt the beating heart of the city and really allowed room for a real character piece on Peter Parker.
Just want to ask very, very quickly, are you still hoping that Shang-Chi 2 might happen? Now, our boy's back in the MCU, which I'm delighted to see.
I am always hoping that Shang-Chi 2 will happen, and we are in active development on trying to crack it right now.
Destin, pleasure. Thanks so much indeed.
Thanks.
Thank you
for having me.
All right, that was Destin Daniel Cretton, folks, and Spider-Man Brand New Day is out today, in fact, as we're recording this on Wednesday, the 29th of July, in the year of our Lord of the Rings, 2020-26. Very, very exciting indeed. Who wants to talk about this movie first? It is pretty much the only movie in town this week. Hells Bells, do you want to have a go at it?
Yeah, can do, absolutely. So this brings us back to Peter Parker's story after basically everyone has forgotten that Peter Parker exists, and he throws himself fully, entirely into Spider-Manning with a light sideline in Iron-Manning. Like, he's doing a lot of like 3D printing and developing gadgets and things and stuff. And watching Instagram stories of Ned and MJ off in at MIT, a college, having no idea he exists. And literally 3 years anyway, have passed with them at college and him just Spider-Manning. He's become a hero of the city. He's basically wiped out crime in New York. He has, you know, achieved sort of Batman in between The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises levels of, I've got this.
Very proud.
Yeah, well done him. But he's not a happy camper. He still has no human relationships except for a slightly sort of a cantankerous quasi not friendship with the Punisher, obviously John Bernthal's Frank Castle. And that's where we kind of pick up with him after a sort of like quick, you know, run through that history. He then is called into action to stop a runaway tank, which appears to be headed for the mysterious Department of Damage Control under the control of Tramell Tillman. And there's something weird about this. There is some unseen force that is directing this tank towards its target, something that other people can't see or sense that Spider-Man can see and sense. And he has to grapple with what this new adversary is or who it is and what's going on. His quest also brings him into contact with Bruce Banner, who is now teaching at Empire State University, which is a comic book equivalent of Columbia. He's got the Hulk under control. He's wearing an inhibitor. All is well with Bruce. So
Peter, I'm sure that'll be working out fine then.
I'm sure it's going to be fine. I don't think we're going to see the Hulk this movie, just Bruce. Just ignore the posters. And yeah, Peter goes to him for help because he starts also kind of mutating. Some spidery shit is going down. He doesn't quite know. There's a sort of hand-wavy line about, oh, well, when spiders are on their own and they're unhappy, they can... things go crazy with them. And you're like, okay, I'm sure.
Thank you, Keith David.
I don't think they're very, like, you know, convivial creatures.
I didn't know spiders
loners.
Could feel sad. That sucks.
I still don't think I believe it, but I haven't done the research and I'm assuming they have, so I'll take it as read. Anyway, the film basically goes on from there. So he has to find this mysterious person, unravel this mysterious mystery, potentially work with the Punisher, not the easiest thing to do. And maybe we hope find a way to get Peter Parker's life back to some degree after the events of the last film. We hope, but it's not going to be easy. So look, I still think Tom Holland is an incredible, incredible, both Peter Parker and Spider-Man. I think he's great in this film. I don't think we have enough for Zendaya to do, but everything she does is very good. And we get these new characters, you know, we get new people to kind of sink our teeth is the wrong word into, but we get new people for him to bounce off, which I very much enjoyed. I think it's a more tightly plotted film than last time. I still think there's some plot holes you could drive a truck through or a tank. I think that there are some cool action scenes and some others that are a bit just CG crazy. But overall, I thought the emotional beats really hit pretty hard in this movie. And I thought that was where it was really strongest. So yeah, really enjoyed it, actually. I don't think it's up there with like Into the Spider-Verse or No Way Home for my personal favorite Spider movies. But I really enjoyed this and I'm really looking forward to seeing it again.
I think in terms of the emotional stuff, it got me a little bit misty at points. Mm-hmm. And I think the character stuff is so good. The general dynamic in these MCU Spidey movies of Peter, MJ, Ned is such a unique thing that you don't find anywhere else in the MCU. And the character side of this is almost a bit of a mega mix of Raimi's Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2, because on the one hand, you have Peter dealing with these bodily changes and his powers going berserk and not necessarily knowing how to use his powers anymore, feeling kind of overwhelmed by them, whilst at the same time, in being distanced from Ned and MJ, who don't remember who he is, wrestling with the almost Spider-Man no more dilemma of like, I've kind of had to go all in on being Spider-Man because I have nothing else. And so I think emotionally it's dealing with really core Spider-Man stuff. It is, to me, took me a bit back to those Raimi films in those scenes, whilst also presenting a new spin on it. It's not just rewalking it because it's very much in the context of the post-No Way Home spell. And so that side of it really worked for me. The action, I think, is perfectly decent. There are some great shots in there, like cool action shots that have the whole audience going, ooh,
yep, that was me.
Pure like cool factor. And some of the new things that they introduce here, I think, feel really exciting, feel really fresh, will give us a lot of exciting things to look forward to in kind of future movies. And I just had a great time with it. I had a really enjoyable time at the movies. It's too long.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very long.
a lot going on, and I think it does a really good job of managing to tie all these threads together and have a bit of a leads to B, so B leads to C. It's just that you're eventually going like S leads to T, T leads to U.
So you've read a Christopher Nolan dictionary by Helen O'Hara. Wow, yeah.
It really taught me a lot about the alphabet and Christopher Nolan. So I don't know what you'd snip, but I think if it was like 15, 20 minutes shorter, it would be like, go and see Spider-Man. It's so zippy and fun. Not zippy and fun.
Yeah, and as a very quick note, they made a big deal last night of stay through the credits. There's something at the very end of the credits. There is. I wouldn't rank it high among the post-credit scenes. No. So if you're desperate for the loo, don't stress too much. And it is only at the end of the credits, so you can run out during the credits if you need to.
Yeah. Yeah, I largely agree with what you're both saying. I had a really, really good time. And it does feel like the best of the solo Spidey adventures from Raimi, and with stuff that we've been craving from that kind of story, matched with the MCU stuff that this Spidey has grown up in, with all the impromptu team-ups with Hulk and Punisher, and the action. I don't think decent is the right adjective. I think there's some action in this which is among the best Spider action we've seen in a live-action Spider-Man movie. All the stuff they do with the hand is awesome. It did have me whooping and cheering a lot in the cinema. You mentioned Tramiel Tillman. I think he's perfectly cast in this, because if you watch Severance, which you should, great show, he plays a character in that which he's kind of simultaneously ultra friendly, but you're also wondering, are you a little bit shady at the same time? And that, I think, is put to really perfect use as his character, as the head of the damage control. Really loved what Gacino did with the score as well, just to make everything, just to lean into the mature feeling that this gives you. I think he has spoken about taking certain notes out of the theme, which absolutely works. And he plays things in kind of a more sad, melancholy register, which really, really works. I do agree with you that it's too long, but I also, because me and Chris, we've been talking in the past about this film, about how much it has to do and worrying about whether or not it's going to be overstuffed. I don't know if you take those 15 minutes out. I don't know where you take it out and have something that this film is dealing with still be satisfyingly served. But I do agree with you that it's a bit too long. I had a really, really great time, though. I can't see it again.
Also, you briefly mentioned before, and I felt this while I was watching it, if you love the Insomniac games...
I was literally saying, that's from the game!
Like, there's certain moves, there's certain things that they do, but also, as Helen said, the setup of this, we get a bit of a montage of, like, here's a bunch of Spidey stuff he's been doing, and that involves Spidey jumping on rooftops where there's a bunch of guys with guns and zappy sticks, and he like thwips them all onto the walls and stuff. And it, if you like that game or those games, and you like that version of Spider-Man, which we haven't really had that much cinematically, of just like being in New York, taking down bad guys, dealing with some of the Spidey roster, and also just being like a young adult in New York City, moving away from the high school stuff of the previous trilogy, you will get that in this film. Yeah. And you'll be very excited by all of the crazy takedown moves that you're like, I did that.
Yes.
Two anonymous goons on a roof.
This was me last night. Yeah, it's great.
I didn't have, not to bring this back to the Odyssey and Odysseus shagging his way around ancient Greece, I didn't have a problem with the length.
Oh boy.
What? It was... It seemed fine to me. I only checked my watch a couple of times just to see how long there was to go, just to try and gauge what had still to happen. Mm-hmm. I think they very, very confidently handled the overstuffing problem. One of the ways they do that is that one of the characters we've talked about, I'm not going to say which one, is a glorified cameo. And so therefore the focus is squarely on Peter. And you're right, Helen, that means that Jacob Batalon and Zendaya don't have that much to do, because the focus is so squarely on Peter. But I thought that you know, it was very, very well handled.
Yeah, I mean, every scene with them counts. It's
absolutely.
So good.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the most emotional moments I've had in the MCU comes during one of those moments when the three of them are together. But there's also a sense of fun and sippiness. That said, the John Watts movies were comedies, I would say, pretty much out and out, especially Homecoming was a comedy. Far From Home is very, very funny. And obviously No Way Home has like big deaths and stuff in it. So it's but naturally less funny. But once Peter, you know, Peter 1, Peter 2, and Peter 3 come together, it's just just joy. Mm-hmm. This movie is less funny deliberately. Mm-hmm. It's not that jokes don't land. They do land. It's just that there aren't that many of them.
Yeah.
And it is, I think, as I said earlier on, in the we were talking about Spider-Man movies at the beginning, I think this is a much more successful version of what The Amazing Spider-Man was trying to do. Mm. And it is a brand new day, and it does feel very, very different from the John Watts Home trilogy. And I'm intrigued to see where he goes, where this character can go, and if Destin Daniel Cretton is the person to go with him, because I know he's maybe hoping to do, in fact I'll ask him when I leave this place in about 3 minutes, I'll ask him what the deal is with Shang-Chi too, that sort of stuff. So we shall see. But yeah, I had a real blast with it. There's some great visuals. Tom Holland's so good in this so role, good. So good. And yeah, 4 stars, and heartily agree with that.
Absolutely.
4 stars indeed. Mm-hmm. There are some films that have chosen to go up against Brand New Day, which apparently is going to like have an interesting weekend at the box office. It's going to be the biggest movie of the year by some distance, although The Odyssey is doing incredibly well.
Yeah.
Lots of repeat business so far. So fascinating to see how those two films fare,
I know.
Ultimately.
I just hope the one with Tom Holland, Zendaya, and John Bernthal wins, really.
At this point, they've got to be trying to add John Bernthal to June Part 3.
I would imagine,
Not John Bernthal. Who am I thinking of? Tom Holland, that's right. Neither of those two.
Both of them.
Okay, so only one of those three is in June Part 3.
Yeah, it's a real problem.
It is a real problem.
But at least they've got Pattinson. Phew.
Yes.
Anyway, Ish. Let me talk about Ish. This is a new film. It is the directorial debut by Imran Peretta, who also wrote the screenplay with Enda Walsh. And it's a kind of coming-of-age drama. It's shot in beautiful black and white on British streets. Very British film. It's about two little boys, Ish, who's played by Farhan Hasnat, and his friend Maram, who's played by Yahya Katana. And they are both 12. Maram is like older and taller, or taller and looks older, which may explain why he at one point gets picked up by the police, who are going around racially profiling people. And he gets pretty quickly released because he's 12 and literally a child. And also the police are being assholes at the time in this film. But it kind of drives a wedge between these kids, because Ish runs away when the police stop and try and pick them up. And Maram is pissed off, understandably so, and hurt, and doesn't know how to process his feelings of, you know, just anger, essentially, and betrayal and unfairness and everything else. So it's kind of about these two boys kind of negotiating this wedge that's been driven between them, and just the way that they're being treated in their world. It's beautifully put together. It's a short little film. I think it's 87 minutes. It's not going to sort of, you know, fundamentally change your view of the world, but it is really beautiful portrayal of something very real in this country that happens. And I thought the child performances were absolutely off the charts great. These two are apparently friends in real life, so they didn't have to work at that, you know, those scenes of like really being on the same page and almost reading each other's minds. But they, like, this is performance, and they give really good performances on top of that. So I thought it was great. I think it's probably a 4.
Okay.
For us, but yeah, really worth a look if you know you've already seen Spider-Man and The Odyssey, and you want to have something a little smaller, a little quieter, a little bit more focused.
All right. Nothing dreadful on Netflix or Prime Video?
No, it's the end of the month, and they don't tend to release a lot of films then. I couldn't find anything anyway.
Something's just dropped today, which I am excited to watch with a beer and a cheap pizza. It's called The Devil's Mouth, and it is a crappy shark movie starring the magnificently uncrappy Catherine Newton.
Ooh.
It's on Prime Video.
So it might not be crappy.
It might not be crappy.
You're presuming the crappiness.
I mean, it's from the director of Blumhouse's Fantasy Island and Imaginary. So
Jeff Wadlow?
Jeff Wadlow.
Jeff Wadlow.
You're a real Wadlow head.
I was so close.
Wow.
I actually quite enjoyed Imaginary. It's got some loopy stuff at the end.
Huh.
Okay. The Devil's Mouth. I haven't seen it. I will be watching it. My expectations are moderate.
We missed water park sharks recently, you know.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay. I, for one, am upset.
Well, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by... I don't know what date it is, what's happening, or what's out next week, but it'll be good people.
Cool. Have you checked the...
No, I don't have time. I've got to run. Okay. But it's good people. I promise you, good people. I hope. Anyway, speaking of good people, it's time to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Goodbye, Amon Warman.
Peace.
Goodbye, Ben Travis.
Bye.
I'm sorry that this bit was truncated, but I do have to run to interview Destin Daniel Cretton, and I am running late. I've got to swing across London. The problem is there aren't enough tall buildings. It's a real problem.
Imagine that in my brain.
Also, I've got to get these tight underpants on as well to do my swing. I like to swing in tight underpants.
Yeah. Well, at least you're wearing underpants. It'd be worse without.
Now, that would be swinging.
Yes. I must tell Destin Daniel Cretton, no sex scenes. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.